This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Welcome to New Voices Season 2, and in this very first episode of 2021, we hear the work of a young playwright, Tim O'Hare, who fearlessly explores violence, truth, power plays and politics, all in the context of one of those darker ironies of life, simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Is this play Tarantino-esque, or is it just a hypnotically twisted version of Australian life? Tim is reviewed by a man who is hardly a stranger to fearless writing. Power, politics, and truth-seeking? He probably stirs them into his morning coffee to add a little flavour. Peter Frey is editor-in-chief of Crikey.com, but has presided over almost every major news publication in this fair land. Oh, and was professor of journalism at UTS. He knows a thing or two about writing. What did he think of Tim's work? Well, confessions, revelations, and plot twists abound in this episode, including Tim's torment at being raised by loving middle-class parents who encouraged him to follow his ambitions. Poor Tim. What kind of a background is that for a writer determined to portray the complexities of nefarious criminal minds? Nevertheless, he courageously forges on and reads out excerpts from his play, which Peter Frey points out dissects capitalism with a very sharp comedic carving knife. And you caution listeners, there are a few drug references, as well as a few swears. I've made every effort to dumb them down so as not to offend tender sensibilities. I'll leave that to Tim. Welcome, Tim O'Hare, to New Voices.
Thanks, Maria. Thanks for having me.
And I think you're going to be the last person that I'm going to interview in 2020, and one of the first to be heard in the new year.
Yeah, well, hello to those in the future.
Now, Tim, you did make a big impact on our writers group. You just hit us between the eyes with a play.
Probably like a few people in the group, I took the opportunity of COVID and isolation, and I pumped out this play, and I was fairly happy. I sent it to about two friends. One got back to me and said they were laughing all the way through. So I thought, okay, now let's see if I can get some negative feedback. So I thought I'll join a writer's group.
I have to just audio describe you because I want our listeners to kind of get the experience we had. So you sit down. You're a big guy, right? Six, what, four?
Yeah, 3.5.
You look like you played footy at some stage.
Well, no, I thought of myself as more of a nerd.
And he wears square glasses. And you've just heard him, right? He's got a gruff voice.
I get constantly asked where I'm from here in Sydney. People have actually said, like, I speak the Queen's English a bit. I seem, like, from another world when I'm talking to people in Western Sydney. I seem high class. But I guess to you, I probably seem like a typical Queenslander.
I've made fun of your Queensland background.
No, I've always wanted to be a writer. Amongst people who've known me, that's kind of how I've styled myself. Probably had that level of narcissism, which is almost like manifest destiny, where I just assumed I would always become a writer. And
Is that true?
Yeah, I think I probably assumed I'd be not just published at 19. Yeah. I was setting myself up to be a superstar.
Like famous writer.
Yeah. I had no self-doubt before 16, 17. Puberty was a late onset. Then there was more of that self-doubt. So it's only like in the last couple of years where I actually thought, shit, I'm getting too old to really be that young writer anymore. I mean, I'm 27.
You're a baby.
But still at 27, are you a young writer? You're just like an average age writer. But either way, been writing for a long time. And
because your day job is as...
I got a background in education, now a substitute teacher.
And your parents, are they teachers?
No, I only learnt this is funny recently, but I'm the child of an accountant and a social worker.
You didn't know that before?
No, sorry. I've known that my whole life, but I only learnt how funny that was. Telling people in Sydney, everyone assumes my dad must be like this Gordon Gekko Wall Street type guy, and my mum's this bleeding heart lefty, and I'm this weird amalgam of that.
But yes, I can see it now. Don't spoil that picture. What kind of aspirations did they have for you?
They're almost too frustratingly new age. We want our kids to be happy. We want our kids to be successful. Probably in terms of writing, I think my mum more than anyone has believed in that. At one point I was like, Mum, what am I going to do before that? And she's like, oh, you could work in a video store. Well, pretty cool. That was Quentin Tarantino's pathway.
How did that evolve, that writing journey?
I have a lot of abandoned novels and about two completed ones, both of which are unreadable. Written
in your own opinion?
Yeah, well, actually, I wrote my first novel in primary school and I wrote my second one in high school.
You actually wrote a novel in primary school?
Look, it was a noir thriller. So it's not too dissimilar to what I write now.
There's the second one?
Yeah, the second one happened in high school. It had the working title, To the Sins of the Father. But I think Chappelle Corby wrote a memoir called The Sins of the Father. Well, I don't know. Will people get me and Chappelle Corby confused?
Could do.
The genesis of this script that I'm going to read today, I actually wrote that while I was in first year uni. Short story, so I decided it would work for a one-act play. Maybe that will be the story of my life, just going back over things I wrote when I was in high school and touching them up.
Why were you drawn to crime?
At heart, I'm a movie buff. I watched way too many movies. One of my favourite movies be In Bruges. And I like that dynamic of exploring philosophy and morality through people that are a bit more blunt.
Do you call it crime or do you call it living outside the rules of society?
I wanted to write the kind of things that 27-year-old me wanted to write about. So I wanted to include politics. I wanted to include philosophy, betrayal, and I'm into decision making around that.
Yeah.
I prefer my protagonists to be from the wrong side of the tracks as opposed to all philosophy professors who are incredibly polished, because that's not how most people are.
So kind of wry look at society.
There is a bit of an Australian tradition of that laconic philosopher, that homespun wise man.
What compels you to write?
Immortality.
Immortality?
Yeah, I think so. I've always wanted to produce something that will stand up throughout time. That probably drives every writer, whether they admit it or not. It's only been in the last 12 months that I've actually thought, I've got to get my act together. I mean, it's not like I'm terminally ill or anything,
but
I'm almost behaving like I am.
Sitting down and writing must be one of the hardest things in the world. Do you find it difficult?
Yeah, maybe that's why being in Sydney, I've started to have this creative flourish, because I remember, I think James Joyce used to say he could never write in Dublin because there's too many bars, there's too much socialising. Whereas Sydney has no nightlife, not with COVID anyway. With When's Jimmy Getting Back and being a small cast and very dialogue-driven, it's like you're just transcribing what the characters are saying, because you start to get such a feel for how they speak and what kind of thing they would say and how they respond to things that even when you want to stop, you can't.
Fantastic. On that note, how about we get into these two characters?
The action takes place in Jimmy's apartment. The floors are messy, with numerous odds and ends scattered throughout. At centre stage, there is a wooden coffee table with a glass bong on it, and behind the coffee table is a second-hand couch that is well-worn, full of food stains and with tears in the fabric. A knocking can be heard at the door. There is no response. The knocking continues. Lance's voice can be heard from backstage. Okay, I'm coming. Enter Lance, scruffy, 20-something, wearing only his underwear, from right of centre stage. He is an Australian, but speaks with an American twang reminiscent of a self-styled stoner who has seen Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider or Jeff Bridges in The Big Lebowski one too many times. The knocking continues. Wait up! Lance walks across to the far left of the stage and opens the door. Jesus, what time? Enter Mal, heavy set, bearded, middle-aged, and wearing a leather jacket. Mal is a working-class Australian, and he speaks in a gruff, matter-of-fact manner. Jimmy?
Nah.
Where's Jimmy?
He's not here.
When's he getting back?
I don't know.
Lance takes several steps back.
I can tell him you came by and...
I'll wait.
Okay. Mal sits down on the couch. Yeah, man, take a seat, man.
Lance struggles for words.
You're not a cop, are you, man? Because if you are, legally, you gotta tell...
Do I look like a cop?
No, I don't know, are you? You gotta tell me, man.
I'm not a cop.
Okay, good. You can't be too careful, you know, man.
Mal doesn't answer.
What do you want with Jimmy?
I just want to speak with him.
Oh, cool.
There is silence.
You know, man, he could be a while.
Mal doesn't reply.
Like, if you leave your number, I can tell him you stopped by.
I have to speak to him directly.
Ah, true, man. That's cool, man. But, like, I don't know where he is and how long he's going to be.
Lance stutters awkwardly as Mal appears unmoved.
Like, you're welcome to stay here till he gets back, but I don't know when that'll be, so if you want to go away for a while and leave your number, man, I could call you when he...
I'll wait here.
Yeah, cool, man. That's fine, man. Do you want a drink, man?
Tea, thanks.
Yeah, cool, man. No worries.
Lance wanders right of center stage and then stops abruptly and turns around.
Actually, man, slight problem. We don't actually have any tea, man.
Coffee's fine.
Cool.
Lance turns towards the kitchen and then stops and turns back to Mal.
Actually, we're out of coffee. Kinda out of everything, I'm afraid. Ask Jimmy to pick some stuff up if he gets the chance. Don't know when.
Water.
Yeah, no worries, man.
Lance exits the stage and returns with a glass of water.
Here you are, man.
Lance sits down on the other side of the couch.
So, what do you do?
I do whatever the boss needs done.
Don't we all? Well, except me, because I'm unemployed.
There is silence.
What's that usually entail?
Driving around, visiting people.
You mean, like, market research?
No.
They both pause.
What do you talk to them about, man?
Their predicaments. Sometimes they owe money.
Are you a counselling service?
Not exactly.
Cool, man. Well, I'm gonna do a cone. You're not a cop, are you?
You already asked me that.
Lance opens the drawer in the coffee table and retrieves the plastic container of cannabis and a lighter. Lance picks the bong off the table and removes the cone.
Yeah, true. Do you smoke?
No.
Fair enough.
Lance leans into the bong and lights it, inhaling deeply.
Ah.
There is silence.
You ever tried it?
No.
You got, like, religious reasons?
I'm not putting that shit in my body.
Yeah, man. No pressure, man. It's all natural.
I've seen what they put in that shit.
Ah, man, it's the war on drugs and shit. It'd be a lot safer if it was legalized, man.
Mal doesn't respond.
Like, how can they outlaw what grows in the ground, man?
Wouldn't change anything. Most of my work is dealing with dumb cunts who are stupid enough to do all kinds of shit. Legalize or outlaw it completely, these fuckheads are gonna keep doing it and keep getting into strife.
You're talking about harder drugs, man. I don't do them, just the natural stuff.
Doesn't fucking matter what it is. You hand over your money to some scum, you get no fucking idea what it is you're taking.
Yeah, but like, man, people should be free to choose.
Freedom! Freedom! What about responsibility? People take that shit and they piss away their responsibility to their family. You want to throw your life away? Fine. Just make sure you got no dependents and you got enough money to never need to borrow.
There is silence.
So, what's Jimmy done?
That's between Jimmy and me.
Is he in trouble?
He will be if he doesn't get back.
Should I call him?
Might be an idea.
Lance looks around nervously. Just need to find my phone. Lance stands up and starts digging around under the seat cushion.
Actually, man, do you mind getting up?
Mal sighs and gets up as Lance starts digging around underneath the cushion Mal has been sitting on. Lance retrieves his phone from underneath the couch.
Found it!
Nice one.
Lance and Mal sit back down on the couch.
11 o'clock and you've already found your phone. Your day's off to a flying start.
Lance presses a few buttons on his phone. He's not picking up.
Well, leave a fucking message.
Hey, Jimmy, just wondering when you'll be home.
Cheers, Lance.
Well, that was convincing. He'll be coming home now.
What do you want me to say?
I don't care. Just that he needs to get here.
Should I tell him you're here?
Are you a bit special?
No.
Of course you don't tell him that the person he's running from is here.
You gotta entice him to come. Be creative. Tell him you got two hot birds over here. But I don't.
Mal laughs and slaps his forehead.
What happens when he gets here and sees it's just you?
When he sees it's me, those two birds he made up will be the furthest thing from his mind.
Well, what's he gonna say to me?
Don't worry about that.
Easy for you to say. You don't have to live with him. He can be quite passive-aggressive, you know.
Let's just say, your living situation will never be the same again after today.
Ah, man. Are you sure you don't want a cone? Mal doesn't respond. Come on. You only live once.
You're not gonna quit until I've had one, are ya?
No.
Fine. Pack me a small one.
Lance passes the bong to Mal.
What do I do?
When I light it,
inhale. Mal awkwardly inhales for a few seconds, then moves the bong away.
Okay. Now what?
You didn't hold it in for long enough.
What?
You gotta hold it in your lungs for a few seconds.
Mal inhales for a few seconds. Mal holds his mouth shut awkwardly, then coughs repeatedly.
Why do you do this shit to your body?
It's fine if you do it right.
Imagine the cancers that are growing away down there.
Bud cures cancer.
Mal laughs uproariously.
You really are a weird cunt, aren't you?
I mean it. The guy from Cheech and Chong had tumours and they reduced in size.
Cheech and Chong?
You don't know Cheech and Chong?
Do they owe me money?
One of America's greatest modern sketch duos.
And you look to them for medical advice?
No. The point is that one of them had cancer and he smoked bud and the tumour reduced until it disappeared.
And had he ever smoked bud before the cancer?
Yeah. Why?
So, you credit bud with the recovery, but not the cause?
Bud doesn't cause cancer.
What next? Ecstasy cures Alzheimer's?
No, that's ridiculous.
Tell me, if bud cured cancer, why can I get it on the street for under $50?
Cause of the pharmaceutical industry, man. They want to push their products, which will make you sicker.
Why would a business want its customers to get sicker?
So they'll keep shilling out money for their products.
What happens when those people die?
That's right. They'll keep getting sicker, and a lot of them will die.
Surely, it's bad for business to have your customers die.
You're one to talk.
Oh, don't kill me, customers.
They must have been, once upon a time, right? I mean, you're whacking them because they owe you money or something.
Some of them.
Well, surely, it's bad for business if you keep whacking them. How are they going to pay you if they're dead?
Well, the hope is it doesn't get to that stage.
But it does, and that's where you come in.
Yeah, I'm the final line. I exist so that people think twice before crossing it.
Wouldn't that make people think twice about borrowing from your boss?
You would hope.
But if they stop borrowing from you, how does your boss make any money?
Because people are idiots, and they will borrow even when they know full well that I will track them down and shoot them.
Peter Frey, welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here, Maria. Thank you.
We've just listened to Tim O'Hare. I think we laughed equally at his interview as his play.
Indeed. I love the fact that he wrote his first novel when he was in primary school.
Yes, a noir novel.
A noir novel in primary school. I'd love to read that. I mean, I think he should publish that. I'm sure his plan is when he becomes mega famous, he'll publish his first novel, Tim, age seven.
He seems to be up for anything, actually. I loved
his attitude. I thought he was so dry and very funny. And one of those great examples where the writer came through the work. You listen to his interview and then listen to the extract.
Yeah.
You go, oh, yeah, I get it.
Those parts of his interview about his journey as a writer, and you, of course, Peter, being a writer,
Yeah. I started as a graduate on the National Farmer magazine in Queensland.
You're a Queenslander too.
No, I'm not a Queenslander, but Queensland. I went to University of Queensland as well.
You know the natives there.
I know the natives. Back when there was lots and lots of money in publishing. Yeah,
and it was an august trade.
It was. It still is. In my lifetime, I've seen the end of the golden age. We're in the sort of bronze age now.
Thankfully, we've got your publication, Crikey.com. Mm. Does not appear on paper, but does online.
Look, I think we are, in many ways, I think we're blessed. The digital world enables people to do things in so many different ways. I think in digital, it makes you work harder.
If you look at the way that you've metamorphosed in your writing career.
And I should mention that I did go to NIDA Playwrights. Unlike Tim, I am a failed playwright.
Did you do that before journalism or after journalism?
Well, sort of during. I was news editor at the Sydney Morning Herald, and on Monday nights, I took myself off to NIDA. Which was a lot of fun.
But it's very different types of writing.
We're seeking to make sense of the world, right? And make sense of the world in other ways, visual ways, say, for instance. And I think writers tend to use words to interrogate the world. I mean, that's what journalists do. Mm. And to interrogate it and seek, people say, oh, you're a sort of truth seeker. And I think, yes, we're truth seekers. I'm not sure if we ever find truth, per se. Also, in terms of a playwright, screenwriter, in Tim's case, I wonder whether Mel in the play is ever going to find truth. We'll hear that when we hear the rest of the play. Yeah.
This is what I love about this little play, is that it does have that feeling of waiting for Godot.
Oh, yeah. If I felt a kind of cross between like John Birmingham's He Died With a Falafel in His Hand, with a bit of Pinter in there, maybe, you know, that sort of vibe. I think Tim's got something there going for him.
What do you think of that notion of growing up with movies? They're your inspiration almost more than other writers. With Crikey.com, you're doing it online. He's using a different platform. You're using a different platform for developing stories.
Absolutely. No, that's a great point. The challenge, I think, for playwriters, of course, is so many of us, all of us really, grow up in that sort of visual medium. Mm. And, of course, plays are different than film.
Yes.
You can do so much more in film in some way, in so many ways.
Yes.
In plays, obviously, the mantra is always show, not tell. A film, you're always telling.
He was really quite marked in his view that this is a play. He was also thinking about current times. Mm. So you can't afford a lot of actors. You can't afford...
Yeah, just the two will do. I think he fulfills a lot of the basic premises of a play. You've got Mel who wants something. So your question all along is, does Mel get what he wants?
Yes.
So you're forever asking, you know, is that guy going to come home or not? Is he going to get what he wants? And then obviously things evolve.
Yeah.
And the balance of power in the play, that stuff we've heard, clearly has changed already in the first, you know, 3 or 4 minutes there. So Mel has obviously got all the power when he walks in, and then it changes and he has a, you know, he has a bong and things are loosening up and the power dynamic is shifting. So that to me is a very much a play.
Yes.
And there's something you can't do in film.
In a play. It's a two-way thing, whereas a film is very much one way.
Absolutely. I mean, a theatre, think of it, is that you have a bunch of people creating something together.
Mm.
Play is an intimate relationship between the people on stage, the writer, everyone else who's helped create that play, like the lighting and what have you, and the audience. It's a mutual moment. Yeah. It's an exchange in the dark, and it's very intimate.
You sound like you still miss not having...
Well, I've seen a lot of plays. And playwriting and journalism, though different, are not dissimilar. What you're still trying to do is tell a story, a narrative, making choices all along to tell that narrative.
Yeah, you're a spare writer. I was reading a couple of your articles.
Well, Grace. I think you get better at that as you get older. I remember my first few pieces at the Herald. I mean, I was so excited I arrived at the Herald, you know. And I sort of overwrote to buggery, really. Yeah. And everything was horrible. And I think it took me about 2 weeks to get published. You know, it was the most devastating 2 weeks of my life. I mean, this is my tip to young journalists and young writers. Read the people you admire and understand why what they do and why they do it and why it works. Before I went to Crikey at UTS in Sydney teaching journalism, and my mantra to the students was always, do you need this word?
Peter, why did you go back into... people must do this to all the time. Why did you decide to go back into the fray?
Well, I think it's in the blood. And then there was this digital revolution. And the digital environment we live in offers so much potential. Something like Crikey, I think, has enormous potential. You know, it's independent, it's feisty, it's Australian-owned. And we've had an amazing year this last year, I mean, of course, but we had a remarkable uptick in subscriptions. Yeah. I also think there's a need for independent publishing. Mm. So you've got these two big media companies in this country, plus the ABC. You know, you've got to get pointy elbows. You know, I've done a startup, worked at Fairfax for a long time, worked at News Limited, and the chance to sort of have a bit of pointy elbows moment to try and help some independent publishing was a great opportunity.
you also run PolitiFacts, is that right? Standard. What a shocking thing.
I know, remarkable facts. That was a remarkable experience. It was one of my most fun years in journalism. This question of whether you pay for news. Think about it constantly as to, is this worth paying for?
Mm. But coming back to money and writers, I know that we both laugh, but that someone like Tim, he's a good writer, realizing that it's not going to pay him any money. If you're a person who's very much into politics, what did you think about the political commentary that was woven in that story so pithily?
Yeah, nicely done, I thought. Really nicely done. Sort of exposition around class. You know, he's right. Big Lebowski things do give you a great position to look at society, the wisdom of the stoner. But then juxtapose that, of course, against Mel, who's basically an agent of capitalism. You know, a rough side of capitalism.
And he's a working class guy. He's the blue collar.
He is. But he's the guy who goes, well, you know, you pay your debts. Not, I'll break your legs. I mean, Guy Rundle, if he was here, I'm sure he would have a much better analogy than me. But this seems to me like there's a great example of late stage capitalism happening in this play. The stoner who's basically given up and the kind of bottom feeder of capitalism come to collect what's left of the debt. You know, they're kind of, they're scraping the barrel here.
It's great.
He's going to break his legs for $50, you know.
But also, Mal has done the analysis and he's breaking down these middle class self-justification. Mal is the hardworking person who believes in his trade.
Work ethic.
In fact, whacking people.
That's right. Yeah, totally. I mean, that's why I mentioned Pinter and it reminded me a bit of the birthday party. There's a sort of level of unstated anger and aggression and violence. In the presence of Mal, as soon as he walks in and as soon as he opens his mouth, this is a man of violence, but a man of few words.
Yeah.
Because violence doesn't need too many words, really. Yeah. Basically, it's menace.
But you can see that he's disarmed by somebody like Lance.
Well, having a cone probably disarms him.
Yeah, but he convinced him to have a cone.
Yeah, that's true.
Mostly through this, oh man, you know, yeah, come on, man,
take it. Yeah,
right. Why not? Which is a middle class, privileged, wearing down.
Drip, drip, drip. I thought it was great. I'm looking forward to it. I like to see it performed. I can see it being performed in the dark, and I can see that sofa, and I can see the bong, and I can see the characters.
And I can see Tim in the background, very pleased with himself.
Oh, well, as he should be. I thought that Mel being a man of few words, the way Tim sort of, his circularity of his words, they were sort of, yeah, man.
Lance, which is a lot like Tim, actually.
I'm sure. Well, I suspect it's a persona of Tim. I mean, they do say you should write about what you know, right? So he was like a physicality of smoke, in a sense, you know, the way he
was. You're so right.
He sort of wove himself around Mel, eventually kind of gets into his skin, under his skin. But I like the two very different, at the same time, two extremely Australian archetypes, really.
Because it is quite Australian. It doesn't seem like it's been translated from an American gangster film or...
No, that's true. A very Australian, I think the setting of it, the language, absolutely. I think there is a little spirit of meeting, but there was a slight egalitarian view because the two men, they really want to agree at some point.
Mm.
I think we are a nation that desperately wants to agree on a lot of things. The fact that we never do, it's probably good news for me as a journalist, but I think we have a predisposition to wanting to agree. That's why I think we find divisive politics so abhorrent.
If it was a Tarantino play, there'd be a much more abrupt...
And yeah, also would have their ears cut off in the first minute.
So none of us have heard the end of this yet. Can you predict what's going to happen? We can both put our guesses down on record.
Well, I don't think he ever comes home. I think they're both changed by the encounter. And that's also one of the precepts of playwriting, that you're not the same on the way out as you are on the way in. Maybe there's an exchange of values. Failing that, Mel shoots Lance. I don't know.
I reckon, that I'm only guessing... Lance accidentally shoots Mal.
Yeah, well, that's not a bad thought.
And so the hitman gets hit.
Yes, yes.
But accidentally, and Lance grows out of it as a human being.
Yeah, I think you've got a better guess than mine.
Well, I do believe that you used to work for a community radio station.
I did. I used to do the Fourth Estate on 2SER. I think community radio is fantastic. We need community radio because it's obviously a training ground.
Yes.
And And it is remarkable, I think, how many people say from 2SER go on to commercial radio and bring a bunch of not just skills but also a bit of a mindset into that space. I think radio is a remarkable way of gathering and receiving information. You know, it's right in your head, it's right in your face.
I think there's a whole turnaround that's happening.
Yeah, right? No, it's wonderful. And we obviously live in the age of the podcast as well. Yeah. I loved it. I miss it. I miss it a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Peter.
And well done, Tim. And thank you so much, Maria.